Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is an MCRIT Wii. Today, another cardiovascular MCRIT episode with our buddy, cardiac maven, Trina Augustine. We'll get to that shortly. Today's topic is going to be the post-CABG patient arriving in the CTICU. You're the intensivist. What do you do? You might be like, I have no desire to listen to that because I don't work in the ICU, or I work in an ICU, but I'm never going to see a CABG patient. You should still listen. So much about cardiac physiology, about managing these patients acutely, that will really ramify on your practice. So you should listen no matter what. And it's Trina. She's friggin' amazing. So listen no matter what. Real quick, tickets still on sale for the Reanimate Conference, reanimateconference.com, and the Flameproof course. In addition, we have our new Out on Time course, which is a course about documentation and shift management such that you leave on time from the ED and from the ICU as well. So if you're interested in that, just go to guidewirecoaching.com. That's guidewirecoaching.com, and you'll just be able to click on the Out on Time link and you'll find more information about that. All right, let's jump right into the show. Trina, it's so good to have you back for another CVM Crit. I am always excited for these. You always teach me so much. And because the CTICU is a different world, and we're going to delve into that world a little bit. Thank you for coming back.
Scott, it's so nice to be back. And there's nothing I like to do than to talk some cardiovascular physiology. So let's do it.
Beautiful. Now, this is going to be, I think there'll be some recurring posts in this vent, but what we're going to be delving into is just the bread and butter cardiothoracic ICU management. And there's nothing more bread and butter than the post-CABG patient. So what made you want to do this as a post and podcast, Trina?
Absolutely. First and foremost, I find that this topic is something that you don't think about until it's faced you in front of you. And I think so many of us go through critical care training, and some people are specifically trained to work in the cardiovascular ICU, and other people find themselves being grandfathered in and it becomes part of their practice. And suddenly they're faced with all these patients post-cardiac bypass. And there's a lot of on-the-job training and learning that goes on, which is not a bad thing. But I've been really thinking about recently how we can really impact these patients' care by partnering with the surgeons and giving these patients the very best outcomes. We've seen that failure to rescue these patients from potentially reversible complications is a big source of morbidity and mortality. So I feel really strongly about anticipating all the expected post-cardiac bypass derangements and optimizing these patients' care.
I love it. And it's been my experience as well, because I had done my first critical care fellowship with no exposure to the CTICU. And I thought I had a pretty comprehensive grasp of surgical critical care. I'd been out for 10 years when I went back and did my second fellowship. And it was the first time I had rotated in a CTICU. And wow, was the conceptualization of things different. And then how involved the surgeons were was nothing I had ever experienced. So yes, it is a different world for the people who are nascent to this realm. You're going to give them a beautiful primer for this. Now, you have written a post that goes along with this that is incredibly comprehensive, beautifully written, and people have to go to it because we can't possibly cover all of it on this podcast. So what we're going to do is the highlights, some of the topics of interest, but you really have to go to the post to get the full breadth. So the way I thought we'd handle it, Trina, is we're just going to plop down a brand new post-op CABG patient. You're the intensivist on duty. You're advising a fellow nascent to this unit, and you're going to teach them everything they need to know to be able to manage it. So anesthesia is rolling into the unit. You got advance notice. They'd be out of the OR in 5 minutes. What is on your mind?
I love it. So this is like real life. I just came off of a 100-plus hour week, and this is what I did all the time. So first and foremost, it's making sure that we're there to meet the team. So I think it's imperative to start with an incredible handoff. And for me, that's having my anesthesia colleagues, that's having the surgeon or the surgical fellow there. It's the entire critical care team. And that includes nursing, respiratory therapists. And if you're someone who has like monitor techs who is going to be helping, you want everyone there because it's really important that we all hear about how the case went, because we can say, hey, they had this operation. But nothing quite follows textbook, and it's really important to know the specifics of their case so that we can know what we should expect and how we can help best tailor our care to their physiology.
What makes you say, groan, this is going to be a disaster versus, oh, we'll get this patient weaned and totally cool in 12 hours?
The first thing is when I like keep looking at the OR board and I keep seeing that they came off a pump and then they went back on pump and kind of the hours are stretching out and I haven't heard anything and I expected this case 2 to 3 hours ago, then I know that we're in for a little bit more challenges. Because the longer you are on cardiopulmonary bypass, the more derangements we're going to see. And also probably it tells me that they might have ran into a little bit more challenges with the case.
Like, we think about VA ECMO in its current iteration as a real physiologic insult. But if you ever go to the OR and watch a bypass case, it's like crazy how prehistoric some of this stuff is. They're still using roller pumps and like air interface.
Right?
It scares the hell out of me. So tell me some of the bad physiology that comes from being on bypass.
There's so much. And it's interesting because I've learned to break it down into systems because it affects literally every system. But I think the big picture to take home, I think the things that we think about the most is it causes this massive systemic inflammatory response, like where people have increased vasodilation, they end up with increased venous capacitance, they have third spacing and extensive capillary leak. That systemic inflammatory response causes activation of the coagulation system, and you end up with multifactorial coagulopathy. So now you suddenly have a vasodilated patient that's wanting to bleed. And then from there, it really can affect every organ system.
All right. So I think we could break it down into multiple different systems and what you're going to do for each. What is the first thing on your mind? You've got a report now. It's your patient. Maybe it's in the middle of disaster versus pristine. So what is the first thing you're looking at to optimize?
Absolutely. So the first thing I want to do is, as I'm looking at that patient and taking everything in, I have my whole team working in tandem. There's someone grabbing the labs, and that's going to include everything from coags, blood gases, name it. We have someone already coming for the chest x-ray. We're getting an EKG as soon as we can, and we're getting a full set of hemodynamics. The beauty is my patients come up mostly with a pulmonary artery catheter, and we don't have to get into my thoughts on pulmonary artery catheters, but to suffice it to say, I'm a pretty big fan. So I really like to grab all of those things while I'm simultaneously checking that patient in. And for me, that is a head-to-toe assessment. I'm feeling their extremities. Are they warm and well-perfused? I'm taking in a little bit of everything, looking at their chest tube output, looking for air leaks, the big picture, just a quick overall, making sure my ABCs are covered before I get into each organ system.
All right. What strikes me immediately is we have the hemodynamic side, we have inotropy, we have vasodilation and vasoplegia, we have volume necessities, and then we have the kind of neurologic side of things. Which should we hit first, Trina?
I think because a lot of us are structured in critical care to start our neuro on down, I think in some ways in this one, it might just be easy to run it through it that way.
All right, let's do it. So what are the neuro issues on an immediate post-CABG patient?
There's a lot, and I think this is shocking to people. I always call the neuro problems the Achilles heel of cardiac surgery. And we kind of forget all the insults that the brain can take. Not only do we have non-pulsatile flow, you have relative hypotension, typically, occasionally, at least throughout the case. And especially on patients that have vertebral or carotid stenosis already, they can have watershed infarcts. We have cross-clamping of the aorta that can lead to atheroembolism. We have the ability to get unfortunate air embolisms to the brain. We have microemboli that can shower. There's like a whole host of things that can go wrong. And with that, you can see ischemic or hemorrhagic strokes. You are able to see post-neurocognitive decline after this, delirium, and even seizures. So my big worry on all these patients coming back right away is, are they going to wake up? Are they going to be neurointact? So I'm really working to get them woke up very quickly and get a neuro exam, especially on those patients that we actually did circ arrest or even a more extensive operation. Because clearly, if this is a patient that had an embolic stroke, they're not going to be a candidate for TPA, but they might be a candidate for an endovascular intervention. And we all know time is imperative. So for me, waking up these patients is one of the first things I want to do as soon as I have them hemodynamically stabilized.
And now you made a point that even if you're going to leave these patients deeply sedated because they're in for a course that requires it, you want to see them wake up first and do an assessment prior to just saying, leave them deep. Now, tell me a little bit about this and why that's so important.
Absolutely. As we just discussed, it's really important for me to identify any neurodeficits right away if they are, because really we need to be able to intervene on them immediately. However, there are going to be those patients that are going to need a prolonged course of sedation. And anybody who's listening to this who knows me is going to laugh because they know I'm very anti-sedation and I try to do just enough analgesia to make these patients comfortable. But I am the first person who has these patients up walking, moving. However, there are times that when you come up after cardiac surgery, you have an open chest. And these are not patients that are going to be up, getting around, moving. And in fact, depending on how that chest is left open, if it's not very stable, there is the possibility of having the RV squeezed in there. So I really don't want them up moving. And they're not the people you want hulking out as they wake up. So sometimes it takes a very gentle awakening and even a Precedex awakening where you can get them to wake up, follow commands, but also not be agitated and moving aggressively. So I tend to go for more short acting agents. And I think in critical care period, we're probably doing a little bit more of this. Presidex, I tend to like a lot. Propofol, unless the patient is incredibly vasodilated and I'm already having difficulty with their hemodynamics, then I may steer away from that. But definitely trying to avoid things like most of us are, benzodiazepines or more longer acting sedatives that's going to make it difficult for me to wake them up.
All right. So this makes sense. So do a quick wake up to assess for major neurodeficits because there's horrible things that could have occurred in the perioperative period. And then if they have an open chest and therefore you're not going to rapidly bring them to a state of just analgesia, if possible, such that they'll be able to move around, but they won't be sedated. If you're going to put them back down, it's going to be with short acting agents that are not going to accumulate. Now, this might be a wild card, but let me ask this. Most of these patients, whether it's purposeful or not, are going to be hypothermic. Sometimes they're actually deliberately put there, but sometimes it's just the interface of all that blood with room air and all the tubing and such. They get hypothermic. In the post-cardiac arrest world, we would be like, we would shun the idea of rapidly warming because we know there's a secondary brain injury that comes from it. And yet these patients have taken neurologic insult and we warm them up right away, like super rapidly. Is that contributory possibly to why some of these patients will have neurologic defects?
I love that question. It's super interesting. And I don't think we, you know, have data that necessarily gives us an answer on that. But what I will say is I think these patients are very different from our cardiac arrest patients and that these patients had good perfusion for the most part going into the case. And then if they were cooled rapidly and they did not suffer that same kind of hypoxic injury and insult to their brain, there's definitely a component of a, you know, reperfusion injury that they are going to see here. But I think it's less, much less significant. And I think in these patients, the downside of keeping them cold is the amount of vasoconstriction we see, which can impair our cardiac output, it worsens our coagulopathy, it makes them at a higher risk for arrhythmias. I think for the most part, most of us move towards quickly rewarming them. And I really do think it comes down to the difference of they didn't suffer a prolonged kind of ischemic time before.
That makes complete sense. All right, should we move on to hemodynamics?
Let's do it.
All right, now this was always the eye-opener for me when I first started doing these post-CABG cases in the CTICU was some of these patients just are intractable in their desire to read super low on their blood pressure. And that's a multifactorial thing. So how do you go about evaluating it? Let's say the patient comes from the OR, they're already on multiple pressors and they're just not where you want hemodynamically. What's your evaluation and then treatment management for these patients?
I think the first thing I do is just take a deep breath and step back. I think it's so interesting because hemodynamic lability in these patients is the norm. It's probably the only ICU that you're going to see clavitopine and norepinephrine charted side by side within like minutes of each other. And these patients are like on a roller coaster. It's just up and down. So I think it's really important for the cardiovascular intensivist to really get this kind of mindset of I'm going to be very vigilant. I'm going to use equanimity when I approach these patients. And I'm going to make sure I don't react to self-limited hemodynamic swings. And yet, at the same time, I am being very vigilant about seeing if there is a concerning trend and acting on that. And I say all that to say, because it is, you're absolutely right. They come in, they're on 4 or 5 drips. Sometimes if you're fortunate, sometimes more than that. Sometimes the methylene blue is infusing as they roll up and it's just not going to be a good day. But then I break it down. I mentioned that I initially have my whole set of hemodynamic numbers for my pulmonary artery catheter. And I try not to put too much stock in a static number. To me, it's more the trends and following all of that. But then I really do, I break it down into preload, afterload, contractility, and my rhythm. And I go from there because it's always the question is, what can I optimize the most and what is driving the hemodynamic instability?
All right. So now, which parameters are you looking at first? Are you satisfied with a PA catheter to evaluate the heart function, or are you adding echo into the mix? How are you going about this? I'm the fellow, advise me.
I love that question because you are rightly bringing up some questions that we get asked all the time. I think the PA catheter is invaluable and being able to get those numbers and know what their right atrial pressure is, knowing what their pulmonary artery pressures are and the trends with that, and even being able to get a wedge if you want that. And then most importantly, getting that cardiac index and the trends in those is really helpful. Now, there are times when, as we both know, it does not give you the full picture and you do have to incorporate echo. And unfortunately, in these patients, as much as I am a huge advocate of TTE, I'm learning frequently that I have to do TEE just because you know, A-lines are your enemy. And after someone's chest has been open, it's incredibly challenging to get really good windows for the most part. But I find that I can typically start the resuscitation based off of my pulmonary artery catheter numbers. And then your good physical exam, are they warm and well perfused? And check your labs and make sure that you have the big picture. So for me, when they come up, I'll get those numbers. And I think it's really interesting because I try to put these patients in buckets for the fellows so that they know what they're looking at. There's different phenotypes on these patients. I find that one of the most common phenotypes that I see come up are those patients that have a very elevated systemic vascular resistance, maybe normotensive to slightly hypertensive, and have a low cardiac output. And everyone is thinking, oh, I just need to try to afterload reduce them and stuff. But my question is always like, why is their systemic vascular resistance so high? Typically, what you'll find is these are patients that are dry. Maybe they did a lot of ultrafiltration downstairs. Maybe they were really careful on their resuscitation. And now, because their cardiac output is low, they have really clamped down to make sure that they have an adequate MAP. And so really, what they actually just need is some volume resuscitation. And you'll see their SVR coming down nicely, and their cardiac output will go up. And that's really all that they needed. It wasn't that they needed necessarily clavitopine added on. Now, there's times when they will take that. But what I'm really getting at is it's really important to see what is driving kind of your hemodynamic derangements and make sure that you're treating that.
All right, let's stop there. So what are you using if you did feel they needed some volume to address their elevated SVR and decreased CO?
It depends if my incredible advanced care providers or me made it to the bedside first. Because if it's them, it's probably albumin, which is not wrong. And I laugh about this all the time because there's not good data on which fluid is the best. And clearly, we have had so many studies in critical care looking at different fluids. For me, I do try to stay with balanced fluids. So typically, that ends up being lactated ringers, plasmolite, and I absolutely will give albumin. I think that our studies on albumin haven't showed that it's superior, but there is maybe a little data that by giving albumin, you can maybe minimize how much fluid you're giving. So I think especially on the patients that I'm worried about volume overload and I want to be a little bit more judicious, I might reach for some 5% albumin. But otherwise, I tend to just stick with balanced fluids.
So that's one category. What about the patients you feel this is primarily an inotropic issue?
Absolutely. And typically, this is a large portion of our population. And maybe it's the subset that I deal with because I tend to work in the mechanical circulatory support unit. And so I deal with some of the sickest patients. A lot of the ones that are fast-tracked and early recovery patients are not the ones that I'm seeing on a daily basis. So just to set the stage. So for those patients that come up that right away the problem seems to be a cardiac index, typically you get that clue when they hand off to you and they say post-closing their index downstairs was like 1.7, their closing TTE unfortunately showed that LVEF of 25%, the RV was moderately down, and you have a really good idea going into this that this is going to be an inotropy problem. Their CVP is already sitting at like 18, their blood pressure is marginal, and they're cold, they don't look great. So then I always come back to which inotrope and how do I want to approach this? Because we don't have a lot of data. In fact, I know you and I want to tackle this topic sometime in the future, so I'll be brief. But I do think it's really important on these patients to really choose your inotropes well. And when I say this, I know that there's not data to support necessarily my reasoning. One of our recent trials, the DORA-MI trial, which looked at milrinone versus dobutamine, really didn't show any significant difference in outcomes. The question becomes, how do you decide which inotrope is best? And I love this because I think so many other things in the cardiac ICU, we really get to tailor the best inotrope to our patient's physiology. So I look at what else is going on with this. Is this a patient that has they have pulmonary RV dysfunction as well, and their pulmonary vascular resistance is really high, then I might consider a drug like milrinone, which I know is going to really be helpful to decrease their pulmonary vascular resistance. Or is this a patient with terrible renal function, and I'm really worried that the milrinone is going to accumulate? Am I going to go with something like low-dose epinephrine or dobutamine? And I do find that if you need something to work immediately, you're also probably going to want to reach for a drug more like epinephrine, low-dose, or dobutamine. And milrinone, even though it might say onset is within 15 minutes, I tend to see at least 30 to 45 minutes before I see any difference. I do think it's really important to mention here, because if it's someone who's reading a lot of the literature, they're going to be like, are you sure you want to use epinephrine? Hasn't it been linked to worse outcomes? And I always love when my fellows bring this up to me, because one, I know they've been reading the literature. And two, because I think it's something that's really good to talk about. So if you look at the trials that looked at epinephrine, there's a couple of things to note. One, there's a ton of confounding. Typically, I find that epinephrine was one of the last.
Hey, folks, we're just going to stop for a second because this is a free episode. I'm giving it to you in its entirety, but it's very rare that we have these full free episodes because MCRIT is a members-only site that still has foam. But if you're enjoying this content, please consider becoming an MCRIT team member. It's inexpensive. You get CME. You could write it off on your taxes, but forget all that. What it's going to do is make you the best possible resuscitation and critical care doctor you could be. You'll have the most cutting-edge, up-to-date information, and you will get it in the comfort of your car or on the subway or while running, and you'll never have to think, am I current enough or not? Am I taking the best care of my critically ill patients? All right, let's get back to the show.
Vasopressors to be added on. And these patients are really sick. And if you look at the vasopressor equivalents that they're on, it's typically much higher in this group. And if you look at the doses they're on, it's really eye-opening. Typically, it's 0.2 to 0.5 micrograms per kg per minute, which is like orders of magnitude higher than I would ever use this drug in a cardiovascular ICU. I'm using this drug at more a 0.01 to 0.08 micrograms per kg per minute range. And if you look at it, this drug has very different effects when used at low levels compared to high levels. At lower levels, you're going to see mostly that beta-1 effect in the myocardium with increased inotropy. And also, very interestingly, the venous system actually has more alpha receptors, a higher density of them than the arterial system. So at low doses of epinephrine, you're actually affecting your venous system more than the arterial system. So you can recruit that unstressed blood volume into stressed blood volume, and suddenly you have a drug that's increasing your inotropy, increasing your preload, and really going to increase your stroke volume and cardiac output without increasing afterload. So I think right now we unfortunately have a paucity of trials that really uses this drug in the way that most of us are using it. And if you talk to most cardiovascular intensivists, we use this drug on a daily basis with really good outcomes.
Yeah, you're obviously preaching to the choir. I've spoken so many times my love of inotropic epinephrine. It's even worse. The trials would use lactate as a surrogate outcome for bad outcome. And the lactate produced by beta adrenergic stimulation has nothing to do with malperfusion. It's just a direct result of that receptor stimulation. So that's silly. And then, you know, the same arguments were made as to why norepinephrine should never be used. The darling of the entire critical care world was Levofed left them dead because only at the point where the patient was actually circling the drain would Levofed ever be added to the mix. So it's the same thing with epinephrine when you look at these trials. So I couldn't agree more. So you have a range. You're going to tailor it to the patient. When do you pull the trigger and say, oh God, this patient's got to get back onto mechanical circulatory support? What makes that decision for you?
That for me is multifactorial. And I find that's a lot of those patients are the ones that I get a clue that I'm going to need to do that. When I have that patient that comes back with their hypotensive, their SVR is incredibly high, their cardiac output is incredibly low, and you're in a really tough spot because an inodilator is really going to even give you more vasodilation probably, and you're having a hard time. And clearly, I'll try one of those, add a little bit of norepinephrine to the mix. But when I start seeing my lactate trending in the wrong direction in combination with they stop peeing, their LFTs, I see just starting to hint that they're going to be bumping, they're cold, all of those things together make me want to jump on this right away. Because as we know, we don't have a ton of robust data yet that says, yes, this specific MCS device in this patient is going to lead to decreased mortality. Although with the Danger Shock trial coming out, we're seeing small, very specific subsets. We're starting to see some really great trials on the positive impact of MCS. But on these patients, what we do know is that if we intervene early, they will have better outcomes. And by trying to get them on mechanical circulatory support, instead of putting them on increasing doses of inotropes, which is going to cause increased oxygen demand and increased workload to the heart, it's much better to rest that heart and allow them time to have recovery.
And this is going to be a really difficult question, but is there anything that makes you lean towards an Impella versus VA ECMO when we exclude lung issues? Let's pretend the patient's lungs are pristine, because that obviously will send you to one direction. Which would you choose?
I think it really depends on the phenotype of the shock in front of me. Clearly, if this is LV predominant shock and I feel like I can get them through with an Impella, I do like that. I have mixed feelings on the Impella CP, so femoral Impellas, and that is because one, I cannot ambulate these patients. Two, it seems like they so often end up with limb ischemia hemolysis, kidney injury. They're definitely clearly in the setting of the Danger Shock trial just being published. They are definitely can be life-saving in a certain population, then I will reach for them if needed. I love axillary Impella 5.5s, but that is another trip back to the operating room. And in the acutely decompensating patient, that is not going to happen. I think if it's LV predominant and I feel like I can get away with a couple liters of support will be enough to stabilize them, I'll go with it. And even very rarely will I reach for a intra-aortic balloon pump, knowing that the amount of support I can provide there is much less. But if it's someone that I think just needs a little bit more coronary perfusion pressure and will benefit from that little bit of afterload reduction, sometimes that's just enough to squeak them by. Unfortunately, if I have a patient with severe RV failure, you can reach for the Impella RP or the Impella RP Flex. There again, if it's just isolated RV failure and the lungs are great, that's an option. But otherwise, if you start throwing in biventricular failure or problems with oxygenation, you're typically left with VA ECMO if you need to put someone on acutely.
All right. Is there anything else we should talk about before we move to the management of afterload and vasoplegia?
I think the one thing that I would just hesitate, because I see this often when I get an ECMO consult, I'll be consulted for someone in RV failure, and they're like, I have them on dobutamine plus milrinone, and they are just deteriorating rapidly. And I look back at the chart, and I see that these patients' blood pressures have just dropped precipitously in the setting of all this inodilation. The thing that I would like to caution people and remind them is, especially when you're dealing with the RV, you cannot tolerate hypotension. You really initiate that RV death spiral. So sure, maybe the right answer is milrinone or dobutamine, an inodilator, but they're probably going to need something like norepinephrine in addition. Just don't let these patients get hypotensive, or frequently they will deteriorate. And unfortunately, that's when they're often faced with MCS.
That's brilliant. And it brings up another question, which is, are you sticking with the 65 or are you pushing these sick hearts a little bit higher?
I love this. So for me, this is very dependent. And my fellows know that because we'll talk about it all the time. So for someone with RV failure, I tend to push their MAPS to 70 to try to optimize their perfusion. The same if it's someone that I know lives at a higher blood pressure or that I'm really trying to make sure I'm augmenting their renal perfusion, I'll push a little higher. If on the other hand, it's that patient that has the new LVEF of 25%, or they just worked on the mitral valve, or I still have a component of regurgitant lesions, or the surgeon says my suture line was really friable, I might let them run a little lower. MAP of 65 will be fine.
Love it. Should we do chronotropy now, or should we actually go into vasoplegia and afterload?
Let's do vasoplegia and afterload, I think.
Great. So this was always an eye-opener to me. It's just how much these patients take. It's what? This patient's suddenly the sickest septic patient I ever saw. What the hell is going on here? So tell me a little bit about how you manage this.
I think this is like one of the things that when you work in this unit that you will deal with the most. And it's true. When you expose that blood to a foreign surface, the amount of inflammatory response that these patients have is truly incredible, especially for those with really long pump runs. I think when they come back to me, I try to see right away, is this just a patient that has pretty great cardiac output, but they are just crazy vasoplegic? In most people's world, that's going to be like their septic patient that comes out. We will start with the typical drugs we'll use in any other ICU, meaning norepinephrine, vasopressin. But you will sometimes see us have to reach a little further down our pockets than maybe you'll have to reach in some other ICUs. Epinephrine, we can clearly use too as a vasoconstrictor. But I tend to reach, first of all, for norepinephrine and vasopressin if it's pure vasoplegia. But there are those patients that, despite having those two agents on board, that you are running into problems. And then there's times when we'll reach for things that I look at as nitric oxygen scavengers, methylene blue, or hydroxycobalamin. My personal favorite of those two is probably the hydroxycobalamin, and part of that's because I don't need to worry so much about serotonin syndrome with them. I don't need to worry about G6PD deficiency. But with both of those, you do need to be aware that it is possible you could increase your pulmonary vascular resistance. And so if you have a patient that has significant RV dysfunction, you do want to keep that in mind. And then in your way down a part of your pocket, we will occasionally pull out angiotensin. Not something I love to do, but if it is true persistent vasoplegia, we can use that. My goal was to get it off as soon as possible. And that tends to be one of the first drugs I will wean off. Although I will say it's incredible how some people will respond to it and really have a significant increase in their vasopressor requirements otherwise and can be weaned way down off of everything else. So it is really interesting. And I think it'll be interesting data coming out over the coming years with this, because I think so many people fear this drug, but sometimes it can be used really well in our population. But all of that to say, the risk of bowel ischemia with some of these medications is real. So I treat them with pretty healthy respect.
Got it. All right, let's do some more detailed questions on that. First of all, how are you using the hydroxycobalamin? What's the dosing of it? Because obviously most people in emergency medicine and critical care are only experienced with this for its toxicologic uses. So how are you using it in the CTICU?
The nice thing for them is, for the most part, we're basically giving a cyano kit. So the 5-gram kit, which is pretty easy to dose. It's very rarely that I need to redose it, but occasionally we will redose it. And it's very rarely that I would run any continuous infusion. For the most part, for most patients, one dose will nicely show you a pretty significant improvement. Clearly, be aware that you're going to have all the discoloration of body fluids and that sometimes there can be some effect depending on what parameters you're looking at. But it's pretty easy to dose because typically we're just dosing it like they would in the emergency department in those emergencies as well.
Makes sense. All right. Methylene blue. Are you just giving a bolus or are you giving a bolus and a drip?
There again, typically a bolus. Occasionally you'll see someone do a drip, but I feel like I could count on one hand how often I've had to do that, just because for the most part, a bolus is enough.
Makes sense. Norepi, I find people are very resistant to going to higher doses. At what point do you make the transition? At what point do you keep going up on the norepi? And at what point do you say, all right, we're high enough on the norepi, let's try to add in something like the hydroxycobalamin or methylene blue?
So I think here again, that's very variable. I think in the cardiac ICUs, we jump to adding more agents quicker and using the synergy of multiple medications. We are always a little fearful of escalating to massive doses of one drug, realizing that some of these patients have new coronary grafts in there. We don't want to cause vasospasm. So I think most of us, by the time we're hitting 0.1 of norepinephrine, are wanting to add another agent on. I think it's really helpful on a lot of these patients to have the kind of synergistic effect of multiple agents, and they seem to have a sparing effect on using as much of one agent. But it's variable. Norepinephrine especially, you might see us running a little higher than drugs like epinephrine, because clearly on that, I'm very careful how high I go.
And when you have to have had resorted to angiotensin II, have you found any correlation with patients who have been on ACE inhibitors or Bs rather, or you haven't really found anything that's a through line for who actually has to go to these medications?
Not anyone that's specifically as far as preoperative medications. I think I just more likely see this in patients that have had prolonged pump runs, needed to go back on pump, the really sick ones that have been down there for a while. We tend to see this a little bit more likely in those patients.
All right. And this is a question that harkens back to earlier, but I'm curious. The PA catheters are actually coming out of the OR. Are they just your standard PA casts, or are you having continuous cardiac output swans? Or are you having continuous SVO2 swans?
So we here at Mayo have the standard ones. When I was at Emory, we did do the CCO ones. I think it's going to depend on what practice you're in. Here, it works for us to not have the continuous CCO ones because I actually have incredible monitor techs who will come out whenever I want and actually shoot a beautiful thermodilution where they are doing it all the appropriate way. The patient is perfectly leveled. And so I do think we potentially get a little better numbers this way than if I just have a CCO swan in, if someone is not making sure that they are leveled appropriately and have all of that. Because I found with the CCO swans, frequently numbers got slid across and sometimes I didn't always believe them as much. But all of that to say, the CCO swans are wonderful too. I think either one of them can be used really well, as long as we are thinking thoughtfully about the data and then intervening on it. I really think that they can make a difference.
All right, let's move to chronotropy. Now, every patient I got who would make it to my unit had pacing wires sticking out of their chest. Is it a norm that you don't get that in your place? Is it variable?
Well, depend on the operation, but for the most part, most patients are going to come back with atrial and ventricular wires. And I will tell you, I get a little nervous on the ones who don't come back with A and B wires, and especially frustrated with the ones that don't come back with A wires. Because as you and I both know, bradycardia is really common in the postoperative period. Whether it's a combination of patients being on medications for AFib prophylaxis like beta blockers or Amio, or it's the electrolyte derangements, direct surgical trauma to the site, especially after valvular surgery, or even just myocardial edema, these patients tend to be bradycardic and maybe even have heart blocks. And so it's really challenging to manage them without wires. At our institution, I'm fortunate because they tend to use unipolar wires instead of the bipolar. And I'm a fan of that. Just for people who are listening, if they're not familiar with the difference, with unipolar wires, I'll come back with 2 atrial wires and 2 ventricular wires typically. And either of them can function as the positive or negative. So either of them can be my ground. And the reason I like when they put 2 wires in instead of 1 bipolar wire is if one of those unipolar wires go bad, I can actually reconfigure a circuit by sewing a new ground onto the patient's chest. And so I can really salvage wires, which is really important on patients that have underwent like valvular surgery that have complete heart block with ventricular escape rates in the 30s, because we want to give them days to have recovery of that rather than having to jump to a premature pacemaker. Because long-term pacemakers do, it's not great if you get a pacemaker and don't need it. So we try to avoid those as much as possible.
All right. If they do have the pacing wires in, are you jumping immediately to pacing or are you trying any pharmacologic interventions first? For a patient who is having hemodynamic issues, but they're also slow, which means we're going to obviously fix that first before anything else.
I pace them. I love it. And especially when you have A wires, ideally I reach right. I do AAI pacing? Unless it's someone with an AV conduction block, and then I'll do DDD or sequential AV pacing, because you really want to make sure you have that atrial kick to optimize their cardiac output.
All right. What if they didn't come with pacing wires? What would you place a temporary pacemaker or would you mess around with drugs first?
So it depends on the patient. If they came up and they're significantly bradycardic, clearly I would probably reach for epinephrine or isoproterenol kind of in the immediate time. If you're someone who absolutely loves dopamine, it definitely is a chronotropic agent. I have a hate relationship with that drug, but this might be the one incidence in to quickly increase your heart rate. But I do reach for transvenous pacers pretty quickly. We have something called a pacing swan too, where you can use those, but I find that you spend more time trying to place that and get it in the perfect position and then have ongoing capture than just throwing in a quick transvenous pacer. I find that much more easy. And maybe that just goes back to my emergency medicine training, but that tends to be my line to go to.
All right. Anything else we should do with chronotropy before we hit the pain in the butt of postoperative atrial fibrillation?
I think the biggest thing I would say is check your thresholds. And I teach the fellows this all the time. I want them to know their thresholds because especially in those patients with complete heart block, if your thresholds are increasing, you need to one, either reconfigure your circuit or figure out what your next step is going to be, because you never want to be in that situation where suddenly your wires are not working and you've had no warning. That's a tough spot to be in. Also, check your sensitivity. Make sure that you're not going to have an RNT phenomenon. So I really recommend if you're not comfortable with a pacer box, pair up with someone who is and make sure that you are comfortable using it, because I say that would be one of the most dangerous things that we touch in the ICU if it's not used appropriately.
100%. All right. So now let's go to the other side of the spectrum, postoperative atrial fibrillation.
If we have one Achilles heel with being neurological deficits, the other one is probably postoperative AFib. This is something that is so common, and especially with patients that have had combined CABG plus valve surgery, you can see its incidence being greater than 30%. So there's sometimes we'll actually frequently, especially with the ERAS guidelines, they recommend prophylaxis. So some of these patients will, especially the kind of rapid recovery patients that are doing really well, will have beta blockers on board right away, or at least amiodarone. We obviously optimize their electrolytes. And there's some talk that even atrial pacing can help prevent postoperative AFib. Mm. But sometimes despite our best intentions, they go into AFib. It's not surprising. There's a ton of inflammation involved. There's surgical trauma. There's volume overload. There's electrolyte shifts. It just happens. For the most part, like anywhere else, our go-to tends to be amio. If it's a patient that's on inotropes, I'm not going to be slapping a beta blocker on at the same time. Fix the electrolytes. And if they're unstable, cardioversion is on the top of our list as well.
Now, it was in the CTICU that I really developed my practice pattern for continued boluses of amiodarone rather than starting a drip. All of the nightmare in intensive care of amiodarone comes from the continuous drip. And so we would give up to 6 doses of 150, you know, separated 10 or 15 minutes apart. Is that your practice as well?
So I will bolus a couple times. I would say typically I don't give much more than 3 boluses, but it also depends. Part of this is here again, I'm working with this really sick population. And I realize that when I bolus IV amiodarone, it is a little bit like bolusing a beta blocker because that is its first effects. So partially because of the sickness of my population, I will tend to not bolus much more than that. But yes, we'll definitely bolus more than once. We do use drips, but I do typically try to get them off of the drip in 24 hours. If it's not someone who's going back into recurrent AFib over and over, because I really want to prevent long-term amiodarone use. Now, there are patients that will just keep going into it recurrently, and we will consign ourselves to having a 4 to 6 week course with having strict end dates. Because for the most part, if you're only on it for a couple of weeks, there's really not a lot of long-term bad outcomes.
Now, again, the post is comprehensive, so there's going to be a ton of stuff we haven't hit. Is there anything we need to hit in this brief primer before we send people to the post?
Yeah, I think one big thing that I would want them to be aware of is if you have a patient that's having ventricular arrhythmias, that is not normal post-op. That always, the moment I come on and someone's, yeah, they were having runs of VT, and I'm my dander goes up instantly because I'm thinking, do I have ischemia going on? Did one of their grafts go down? Was this someone that had valvular surgery and we caused an iatrogenic, you know, coronary injury? These are the patients that clearly treat them with amiodarone, lidocaine, shock, whatever you need to, but make sure that you're sending them to the cath lab and you are making sure that those coronaries are pent. And maybe it is just someone that has terrible disease and they have a persistent VT burden, but I think it's important to rule out the things that we can fix. If there's nothing to fix, we have a low threshold here to go to stellate ganglion blocks. And clearly, if it's persistent arrhythmias, sometimes these patients end up on ECMO, but that's not something you want to be facing if you don't have to.
I love it. Now, we could do a whole show, and perhaps we should, on the cardiac arrest in a post-cardiac surgery patient. I think that would be a fun episode. So we're not going to dwell on that here, even though that's certainly something you need to have in your back pocket as a knowledge base. But I think we hit a very fantastic breadth of information for this. And again, we'll refer people to the post. I cannot thank you enough, Trina. This has been fantastic. And hopefully it will help some scared, nascent people who are starting in the CTICU.
It's been an absolute pleasure. It's always so much fun to talk about this. So thank you for having me on again.
As always, we will have you on many times in the future. All right. Hopefully you folks love that as much as I did. If you want the show notes for this, just go on to mcrit.org. You'll find it. If you want the specific link, it's mcrit.org/cabbage, not the vegetable. CABG, mcrit.org/CABG. Scott Weingart for the MCRIT podcast saying bye-bye. You hate that sound. I hate that sound. Why are you hearing that sound? You're hearing that sound because you are a unpaid listener to MCRIT, and yet this is one of those episodes where only the team members, the MCRIT members, get the full episode, which means you're missing out on tons of resuscitative goodness. You're missing out on the optimal way to care for your super sick patients. And it's sad because just going to mcrit.org/join would allow you to get full access, to get access to the RAC literature reviews, full episodes, extra goodies, bonus stuff for an incredibly inexpensive price. Your department will pay for it, or you could write it off on your taxes. You could get it done before the end of the year and become a full MCRIT member. Just go on over to mcrit.org/join, and you will now be someone exposed to all of the information to take care of your super sick patients that you want. You'll get this full episode and be able to actually perform a retrograde intubation. You'll be happy. So just go on over to mcrit.org/join and never hear this message again.